Hey, everybody. Welcome to Politico's off-message podcast from Cleveland. So we decided to get the hell out of the security perimeter for this one. Our last guest was Ted Cruz. So I was thinking to myself, who would be the person that we could get that would be the exact human opposite of Ted Cruz? And we settled upon a hero of my youth, somebody I'm never really nervous before these interviews, and I'm never really that excited after them. But this one was totally different. I'm talking about Chuck D, the front man for Public Enemy, the seminal rap group, the Led Zeppelin of hip hop. Chuck D is in Cleveland, sort of running counter programming to the Republican National Convention. With his band Prophets of Rage, with Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine. And we were just kind of reaching out to him, and he invited us over to the other side of Cleveland to the Agora Ballroom as they were setting up, doing a sound check, to kind of talk politics, to talk music. And the truth of the matter is, he's about 7-8 years older than me, but we really grew up in New York at the same time. I have never had more fun than in this interview. It's kind of all over the place. So Chuck D was setting up a series of interviews today because, you know, he was an Air America host. He's very political. He started off kind of being a Malcolm X guy, and he's still pretty radical. So he was doing, the British press really digs him. So he was doing an interview with The Guardian, and then he was doing a hit with Nightline. So we get in there, and his management completely misunderstands how we do our job. Which is kind of easy to do because we're weird. And they're like, okay, you got 10 minutes. And we walk into this ballroom, and they're testing out the smoke machine. So the entire ballroom, and it's a theater, I'd say about 1,000, 1,500 seats. And so the whole place looks like we're walking through a Hound of the Baskervilles set with Sherlock Holmes. Just smoke everywhere. The smoke machines are getting tested out. And the bass player for the band is doing a sound check, and we're sitting on these stools. So I figured what I really needed to do was establish really fast to Chuck that I knew who the hell he was and that I was from Brooklyn. He is from Queens. And that really did the trick. We started talking about Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York who'd spoken the night before at the Republican National Convention. That really hooked him. He asked me, because he knew I'd covered some politics, if I'd ever really met Giuliani, what my impression was. And I said to him, honestly, any reporter who's ever covered Rudy will tell you this, and I don't mean this in a terribly negative way, but Rudy has a very large head. He does. It's like, you know what they say about TV people, that TV people have abnormally large heads. Well, Rudy Giuliani has a very large cranium, right? And then Chuck started talking about how OJ had the biggest head that he'd ever seen in his life. It was as big as a mailbox. So we kind of, I think we hooked Chuck. And so the first half of this interview takes place right during the sound check when we had our 10 or 15 minutes. And so as he's leaving, he grabs me by the arm and he says, after we're done, I'm going to give you, because you're a Brooklyn guy, I'm going to give you some extra time outside. So the rest of the interview was conducted on the loading dock of the Agora Theater while people were moving in equipment in and out. And Chuck is, how do I describe this guy? He's just a very, very friendly dude. So half the time he's talking to me, and half the time he's talking to these two big burly security guards who are standing next door. So he's just a natural kind of storyteller. So the audio can be a little weird. So the weird sounds that you're hearing are trucks moving by, people moving big boxes. And if you hear a low rumbling, it's the bass player testing out his bass. What was really interesting about it is, obviously, it's a Republican National Convention. Race is a big issue inside the hall. And I thought it would be an interesting dynamic to talk about race outside the hall. So that's why we talked to Chuck, and he had some interesting, somewhat incendiary things to say, as you would expect from a guy who led Public Enemy. Anyway, let's get down to our usual business. Follow us on iTunes. Rate us. Again, we're getting great ratings. Send me an email at gthrush@politico.com. Again, your guest suggestions, we take them really seriously, and three or four of them we have actually acted on. And before we get to the interview, I just want to give you a little, bit of information sort of about the sound quality. A couple of you have written to me noticing that the sound of my voice is a little bit differently. For the next 3 or 4 months, I have to wear kind of a retainer to deal with a dental issue. So it can sound occasionally like I have like a lozenge in my mouth. So ignore it, have sympathy, and listen to me talk to Chuck D. All right, so we were just talking about Giuliani. You did not get a chance to see Rudy Giuliani at the convention.
No, but I heard he was like on some like really terror punk. He was a punk vocalist on the flip side, just talking and spewing the, just the worst ish.
He said the word greatness. I covered Rudy Giuliani in City Hall, and I was just telling you, he has the physically the largest head of any politician I've ever seen.
Red, white, and blue mailbox.
But you were telling me that, is it true that O.J. has the biggest head of any?
Yeah, but O.J. has an excuse. He had tackles, so he had to build his neck and his head muscles up.
Well, politics,
I don't know what Giuliani prepared his head for.
So now you grew up in Roosevelt, which is on the island,
yes.
Kind of on the Queens border.
In the middle of Nassau.
And you were born in 1960. What was it like growing up in that neighborhood at that time in New York City?
I moved out to Roosevelt in 1969. My family moved there. Before that, I lived in various parts of South Side of Queens.
Like Laurelton?
No, South Oldham Park.
Gotcha.
On both sides of Van Wyck. And moving out there, we was like, oh, we're going to go move to the country and find out you're taking a 15-minute drive. But it was totally different because it's Nassau County. I mean,
right.
Paid a toll on the southern state.
Right.
I mean, the parkway is manicured.
Right.
Because originally that's why it was called a parkway.
Robert Moses.
Right, exactly. Yep. You build a highway through the park.
Right.
And that's why it goes squiggly. Because on Long Island, it's a straight shot. So why are you going to make a road go squiggly?
Because all the landowners needed to be accommodated.
No, because driving was for the elite in the 20s.
Right.
So you wanted I'm going to drive and make a left swirl and a right swirl. I mean, especially when you get the Valley Stream, you know what I'm talking about.
Of course.
But, it was a world of difference. I was in a town that two years before my family moved there in 69, it was 65% white, 35% black, maybe 70-30.
Right.
The house that my parents bought from the Milfords was built in 1954. They moved in 1969. So they were only in the house 15 years. We still have that house today in our family.
Did they buy from a white family or a black family?
White family.
How was that received? Because this was the era of the blockbusting and all that stuff.
And this was the era of the blockbusting and the white flight.
Right.
69, it was at least 60-40. Well, maybe, 60-40 white to black by 72. It was like 90-10.
Right.
You know, it could have been 80-20, but it seems like the white kids were all not in the community. They were being sent to other districts for school, and then their families followed not long after, or those that graduated moved on. So white flight was indicative of that area.
How did that sort of, the sense that white people were leaving when you were getting into this neighborhood, and your father, who passed away recently, I understand, I'm sorry for that, hardworking guy, raised his kids.
Yeah. My mom.
And your mom. How did it feel being in an environment where white folks were leaving just because you were black?
Well, we were happy that we was able to be in a house and it had grass and trees, so we didn't care who was living next door.
Right.
So whether they decided to leave or stay, it didn't matter to us. We were happy where we was at, and we saw the block got filled in with other black families and other black kids. It didn't matter who they were. I mean, my first friends on the block were the O'Rourke's, and Eddie O'Rourke's family stayed there till the 80s, a white family that stayed in town. And we were running cats, but the families and the parents moved on to neighboring towns.
Well, my dad's grew up on Euclid Avenue in East New York.
Right.
Where the pink houses are right now.
That was the first example of white flight,
Right.
Well, not in the New York metropolitan area, but in that period of time.
So, but you were a very little kid. You were born in 1960. So 68, 69.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm was killed in 65. So you didn't have a consciousness of that. Did you recall?
I did slightly.
You did?
Yeah, I mean, this person everybody looked at, and at 5 years old, you start recognizing some things. Really clearly evident by 7 or 8 years old when Robert Kennedy and then Dr. King got killed. I was very cognizant of the fact.
Did you grow up in a political household? Were your parents focused on this sort of stuff?
In the 60s, you were focused by default.
Because things were just happening.
Matter of fact, in 2016 has felt like 1968 all over again, and it's felt like the 60s and the second half of the 60s when I went from 5 to 10. It feels exactly the same.
How so?
Loss, number one, my dad, confusion, a nation whose narrative is all over the place and pointing for excuses in every other corner of life, or immigration, ban those people from coming in, Muslims, or you know, the same way that this country is pointing at Muslims now is the same way they pointed at Asians in the 60s.
Right.
Like Japanese might as well have been Vietnamese.
Right.
To the average person. It's like them over there, you know. And I remember I grew up, I was like 4 years old, 5 years old. My parents made it kind of like a joke about it. It's like, well, you know, when you was little, you were afraid of Asian people.
Really?
You see Asian people, because I would watch TV and think that, you know, they're going to shoot us. It's war, you know?
Because of Vietnam.
Yeah, because of Vietnam. And not just Vietnam, but Hanoi.
You came of age, and your music played a significant role. You know, I came of age, I was a teenager in the 80s, and mm-hmm. Public Enemy was a soundtrack to a lot of the shit that I went through. I went to Sheepshead Bay High School, which was 50% black, 50% white.
Mm-hmm.
And there were race riots on King's Highway when I was a kid. So do you feel... The 80s were, as you know, crazy time. People got killed. You lost a lot of people. I'm sure I knew a lot of people got killed. Do you feel the same sense of anxiety now that you did in the 80s? Because the 80s seemed to me to be real bad.
Maybe a lot more.
Really?
Because the 80s were real bad, but you're from New York. So yeah. New York's a melting pot no matter what.
Right.
You can be in Evansville, Indiana, and stay away from the hood part of Evansville. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But in Brooklyn and Queens, especially at that time, you got communities, you know, cheek to jaw on each other and really on top of each other. That's why the Crown Heights situation was so tense, because the communities are like pressed into each other. People take the same mass transit everywhere.
2 and 3
train. So you might not get along with somebody, but that person might be right in your face on a crowded train.
Right.
So New York City had to deal with race a lot differently than, let's say, Detroit, which had its own situation.
Because of the distances.
The distances, the mass transit.
Right.
I mean, it didn't behoove people to drive in any of the boroughs trying to get to work or home. So the transit system was also a key divider and uniter of folks. It united people in a way.
The infrastructure of these cities. And we were talking about Robert Moses as a guy who wanted to use transportation to divide people, right? Explicitly, he was a racist.
Well documented in New York, and Rick Burns, I'm pretty sure.
And then the Power Broker, the Robert Caro book. The other thing is, so getting back to kind of the notion of where things are at now.
Right.
What's more frightening to you is this is much more of a national phenomenon than a New York thing, right?
It is all over the place. Perception is traveling at light speed through these gadgets, faster than the reality and the truth.
Right.
For example. When the Dallas shootings happened, the media put one of our members all over because they took a selfie with him.
Well, tell the story. Why people were all over him.
Well, the media jumped on. You know, here's a picture of the guy, and look who he's with.
Right. The shooter had a picture with Professor Griff at an event.
Every phone out in modern times has a camera to it.
Right.
And people take selfies and. You know, and this picture by association became another fodder in the middle of the flame to take it on to another place. And that was quickly refuted.
Right.
Refuted with fury,
so to speak. There was no connection with that whatsoever.
You take a picture with somebody, I mean, I take a picture with a bevy of blondes all the time, but, you know.
With a bevy of blondes.
It passed hours and all that. So, so I'm saying it's like, but the perception.
Right.
Stings and has a stench and stains and the truth and the legalities move slower.
Right. So the truth is moving tectonically and the information and misinformation is moving at light speed.
Yeah, and the legalities even move even slower.
You know? Let me throw one thing back on you. When I listened to your music as a kid in the 80s, I was angry. I was really pissed off, and you tapped something because I lived in a segregated situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, you know, I'll give you an example. I was in a gifted and talented program, right. All white kids.
Right.
I went to visit one of my English teachers who was teaching a class of all black kids.
Right.
Talking to those black kids in a way that he never talked to us white kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I listened to your music when I was growing up, the rage element of it tapped for me.
Mm-hmm.
Are we getting to a point, now there's righteous anger and there's non-righteous anger, right? Are we getting to a point though where anger as a form of expression is in and of itself creating some of these problems? Because you can see a lot of anger over in the RNC hall, you're gonna see a lot of anger tonight.
Yo, man, processing anger is what it's all about.
Right.
Musicians could process anger into work and art. Artists could process anger into something progressive and uniting in a way. You would hope that people in society, authority, can process, diffuse anger by processing information that's going to be usable for everybody.
Yeah.
But you can't have mythology and hype and perception run around and have anger. You know, I mean, fear of authority turns into, without paying attention to it, turns into anger and distrust.
Right.
And in black families in the 80s, you had the remnants of, we were broke families, but we were never broken. Now you have broke and broken.
It's shattered.
Yeah, shattered today.
Yep.
Back, it was the beginning during R&B, that's Reagan and Bush.
Yep.
The beginning of the broken black family, the broken, like, okay, mother and father, we understand that they are, but mother, father, kids, there's a divide between communication. Now you double or triple that over a couple generations, and you got a shattering by 2016.
One thing before you gotta go to your next thing. When you see Trump, how is Trump's presence, forget about him being a reaction to the anger on the white side of this, how is Trump's presence impacting the way, the anger that you see at your shows, the anger that you see in the people that you talk to? How are people responding to Trump viscerally?
You mean as far as people that
African-American folks and also people who are your fans?
Trump's his way about going about what he's trying to convey is reduced to the lowest common denominator, the lowest hanging fruit.
Yep.
He'll be the first person, if he's elected president, maybe what Teddy Roosevelt used to say, well, I'll bullwhip, you know, the world and whatever.
Yep.
He's the first guy that's going to come in with the middle finger and say, F all of y'all. He'll probably be the first president to use the GTFOH with a council meeting with other nations. That's fearful.
Hey, it's Glenn. This is where we had to pack up our equipment, move outside. Chuck suggested we sit on this loading pallet, which was really pretty filthy, and he was like, come on, man, you're from Brooklyn, you can do this. What I didn't tell him is I only packed one pair of pants for this convention, so I was deathly afraid that I was going to destroy the only pair of pants that I had. So here I am talking with Chuck D. So we were just talking about, tell the story you just told me about the salutatorian and the valedictorian in your high school graduating class.
Yeah, well, in our town, it was salutatorian and valedictorian, and they were like the, you know, kind of like the glamour couple of the town. You know,
yeah.
It was one square mile town in Roosevelt, so everybody knows each other. And by the late 70s, when they actually dated and went out, you know, I guess people's recreational drug went from, you know, weed to cocaine.
Correct.
And
yep.
The cocaine wars happened in Manhattan. Nobody really happened in our New York area. Nobody knew what, but all of a sudden there was an influx,
yep,
of guns and drugs in the black community. Well, if cocaine was the recreational drug, eventually that turned into freebase and then crack, and the people at the party scene, and it was like, oh, it's socially acceptable. Of course, this couple got caught into it. By 1984, both of them were on the main strip, you know, as crackheads doing anything to get their fix. It was like the most ironic, disturbing thing you ever want to see.
So how did you avoid that?
I never smoked and drank. I wanted to be an athlete, but I never was good enough. And I always thought that any smoke or drink would make me whack, but I was already whacking and didn't know it, but admitted it. But also, I was the designated driver.
And you were also a reader, right? I mean, you were interested in a bunch of things.
Yeah, but I always read. But the thing about it, you know, crazy little things made me say no, like... I was the designated driver, and in 1981, and when I was designated driver, what I meant is like, I was the guy, we did a club.
Right.
And, you know, we ran clubs, so I'd be the guy to drive because I didn't want to get in a car wreck with somebody inebriated behind the wheel. So it was like, and the story, short story is, yeah, is 1981, Isaiah Thomas's college team, Indiana, the Hoosiers, won the championship. And one of the key players on that team was Landon Turner.
Yeah, of course.
He got in a car accident and paralyzed. I don't know if it was drinking or whatever, but when I heard that, I was like, yo, man, I got to be the designated driver because I can't see myself
being paralyzed. Wait, but there's always, and it's present in your work, there's a certain steadiness to you anyway.
But that really was the capper.
Yeah, but where'd you get that kind of basic, you seem to me, and I don't know you, like a responsible guy just generally. Like,
well,
you
got
that.
Of course, I'm getting the panoramic view from Roosevelt. I know what not to be. I definitely know what not to be. I'm seeing it right in front of my face. You know, there's such thing as a hood PTSD.
Right.
Yeah. You know, people are like, oh, you got, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, because you went over to Iraq.
Right.
I mean, living in the hood could give you PTSD. Seriously. I mean, Pharoah Monch spoke to that in his album.
So when you are looking at, we've seen Ferguson, how are things, do you think things have improved? I mean, there is a
when
sense.
When I saw Ferguson, I thought of, you know, a place on Long Island because we had similar, you know, zone
car culture.
Yeah, similar.
Do you think things have improved in any fundamental way? I mean, you do have more African Americans on police forces.
That's like life, man. It's like one day you feel better, one day you feel worse. I mean, there have been improvements, but there's also been some serious slipbacks and non-movement. And so, and you figure, man, the thing that even makes it slip notches down is new generations coming in.
Right.
And that's one thing that older generations don't take into consideration. If they have no children or not locked into their children's life, they lose track of time.
Well, look, nation and
military. Your kids are, you know, I mean, I'm not to, I mean,
yeah, yeah.
But, you know, teenagers. In 7 years, they'll be 20.
Right.
You know, mine are in their 20s. So.
Do your kids have that? Because the thing I also, thing I know about, like, yeah, Nation of Millions.
My oldest child is damn near my mama now. So,
really?
Like, I mean, she's so wise and sharp. I got to tell her, like, yo, slow your roll.
But, okay, Nation of Millions is a history. Some of these songs are history lessons. You guys are very steeped in the history of the movement and all that stuff. You were steeped in the history of Malcolm. Do you find that when you go out there and talk with people that this next generation, particularly of African-American kids, have that same sense of history that you did?
Well, you have to speak to the anger. And their access to history is a lot easier than us.
Right.
They can just go to their phones and Google.
But do they?
You got to encourage them to go to their phones. I mean, look, you can lead a horse to water. You also got to tell a horse to drink it.
Right.
Well, you can lead young people to information, but you also got to tell them not how to just access it, but how it could be beneficial. Those are some of the things that diffuse some of the anger.
Right.
Because in youth, there's been an anger train that's been running. It's been running since the 60s.
Did you like Bernie? I mean, Bernie is the one who got the youth this time, or is Bernie a little too mainstream for you?
No, I mean, I like the way that Killer Mike worked with Bernie. You know?
Did you endorse anybody, or did you? Or is that
no,
not your thing in general?
I didn't endorse anybody yet. But if I had to lean towards anything, I liked what Killer Mike was doing with Bernie. I kind of thought in this society, and as far as that job is concerned, I don't think you could be a righteous person somewhat and survive the job of President of the United States.
Well, how do you feel about Obama?
Well, I'm just like saying he's a lot aged because here's somebody who's going to, as black people do, when we get that job, we're going to try to prove that we own that up to that job and we're going to do 200%. But it's taxing when you're going up against the machinery that says we want you to be this way instead of that way.
Right.
So as a black person growing up with Obama, as a black person dealing with Obama, knowing that in 2008 was the first time that my father and my daughter and I voted simultaneously for this man. Yes, it's symbolic. Symbolism is energy, but also being a realistic person, you got to know, and like playing sports, when somebody is coming down and throws you a behind the back pass and winks at you,
right?
You don't catch it. Come on now.
Right.
It's like, yo, you playing with LeBron, man. He throw you a behind-the-back passes. Like, he couldn't telegraph passes to the black community.
Well, and he didn't really.
He's the president of the United States of America. And some of us know damn well that being in that position, he's actually going to do less obvious moves for black folks.
Well, Chuck, I covered the White House for 3 years, and I was in the briefing room.
And President Obama gave you an hour.
Right, he gave me an hour.
But, you know, I would keep bringing this one up. Right?
I like that. Well, it's the only reason I got you. No, the thing about it with Obama was the Trayvon thing really was a pivot for him, also getting reelected. He felt more comfortable talking about African-American issues after he got reelected. And the Trayvon thing really changed him.
Comfortable is the biggest narrative in black people doing anything.
Yeah.
How do we feel comfortable doing the damn job? Every black person doing the job feels some sort of discomfort somewhere from this authority.
A tickling on the back of your neck, like, now wait a second.
Hey, am I right? Yo, I asked my brothers right over here. Anytime we on the job, we feel we got to do like two times the amount of job just to be feeling a little bit comfortable.
True. I say about five.
A salute goes to you, sir.
And just to make it past the trial.
Because everything is scrutinized. Everything. And we can live with the scrutiny, but the double, triple scrutiny is like, okay, and we used to it. We flow with it. Like, okay, I'm scrutinized. I understand that. But I'm going to make sure I'm going to be the best at this job that you ever saw. That's the whole Obama thing. Yeah, you're going to do things for the United States of America. We understand that. But only thing he could do is throw us behind the back passes. Some of us could catch it, some of us can't. And that's 8 years.
So the next person
that's coming in ain't throwing no pass at all. I see you.
You include Hillary. So Obama's campaigning a lot. I just did a big story about how close Obama is to Hillary. Will you go into the voting booth and vote for Hillary Clinton?
It's a mathematic thing. Yeah, voting in the United States of America is primitive.
Right.
More is better. It's primitive. It's a math game. You know, it's one of the things where I couldn't totally nod into the Green Party, and because the Green Party would have fragmented the Democratic vote.
Right.
And I was a firm believer of Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente. I was a firm believer of even, I thought Ralph Nader could have did a job in 99. He called me personally. It became a math
game. Is that true? He called you personally?
Yeah, man.
What did he ask you?
Number one, hey, hello, how you doing? Chuck D, it's Ralph Nader. Right there, I was like, you know, who am I voting for? I'm going to vote for Gore. I definitely ain't voting for Bush. But Ralph Nader called me.
You're right.
And he personally talked to me for a half an hour as I was going to speak at Chico State, and he sold me. But I mean, how many people are going to have the actual candidate give you a 30-minute conversation?
Did Bernie reach out to you this time? I bet you he did.
No, but Killer Mike was Killer Mike is my brother, so the fact that he was working with Bernie was good enough for me.
So you liked Bernie, and now it's the math
Bernie
game.
Look, Bernie realized that in order to have any change in this country, he had to do the math.
Well, let's.
Hillary wasn't going to go nowhere.
Okay, I want to let you do your thing. So let me ask you.
I got
one more question.
You got a clown on one end, and they say that you got a liar on the other end. You could buy time with a liar. A clown, you can't buy no time with a clown.
We're in Cleveland right now, okay? And you've got a history of coming to conventions.
The RNC has turned Cleveland into Clownland.
Let's get back to Giuliani and then talk about Trump, because they're kind of working the same side of the street now. I want to get my heads in Giuliani.
That's a nightmare once again that you always wish they would go away, and he keeps popping up like fucking Chucky the Clown. It's like, dude, man, really, man? It's like, yo, you're not going yet? I mean...
Well, I think we've drained the pool on Rudy. Let's talk about Trump for a second.
Got to reduce yourself to like joking and snapping, like, okay, you know, this is not the same Rudolph or Adolph Giuliani that we had with the stripe across his head.
When he says, I am responsible for saving more black people, or that like 99% of, what was it say? You have 99% times more chance, 99% of people get...
He took all the merchants off the streets in Harlem. This dude, man, I mean, yes, he cleaned it up as far as having a great, what would you call it, a great sanitation job. He cleaned it, he built new buildings, he tore down old buildings, and okay, what else?
Okay.
You had a buddy relationship with the prison system of New York. You're the Robert Moses of prisons, you know.
Okay, and, so Trump, what do you, in general, so you're here in Cleveland, what do you think Trump, I interviewed Ted Cruz on Friday. You're my last interview was, wow, Ted Cruz, and then on to you.
And what did Ted Cruz say about him dropping out and seeing this clownery go on?
Ted Cruz, I asked Ted Cruz if he was going to endorse Trump, and he refused to endorse him. He said he's going to watch the convention and make his judgment like vote, like every other voter.
He's telling a damn lie.
He's sticking with it. But let me ask you about Trump.
He's saying that
he could endorse him as soon as, look, he can endorse him as soon as Wednesday, but nobody, we're talking now on Tuesday.
So what's the deal, since you're the insider on this, what's the deal with this GOP alliance code? It's like the same police code. It's like, right, we know that there's effed up cops, but we got this code of silence where we can't admit that there's effed up cops. We're not going to sell a cop out. He's not going to admit that the GOP is effed up right now.
Well, what people say in my reporting on Cruz is that he's waiting for 2020, so he's keeping his powder dry, waiting till the storm. Actually, this is the question I want to finish with, because it gets to it.
That's that beauty pageant.
His sense, and among his people, is that Trump is a one-shot deal, a black swan or a white swan. Do you think Trump is a durable thing that that folks are going to have to deal with for a while, or do you think that this is one particular moment in time? How long are we going to be dealing with this kind of thing?
He's a virus, man. He's a bad virus. The fact that he's here right now, it ain't going to dissipate. He needs some kind of political penicillin real quick. For real, it's like, it's fascism, man. It's in any other way that you look at it. It's straight out of the textbook of 1934 in Nazi Germany.
All right. Well, on that note of real cheer.
Well, I mean, I have to look. You know, when I look at this country, I always look at it from the outside in.
Yeah.
People around the world, I mean, from the Northern Hemisphere to the Southern Hemisphere, is like, yesterday talking to a young man, he's from Argentina. They don't get it. I'm talking to another few of my people in Cape Town, South Africa. What the hell is going on? Talking to people in parts of Europe and Asia, they're like, really? People say, are you afraid? More embarrassed than anything.
I ask you one fanboy question we're probably not going to include in it. That voice.
Uh-huh. Voice is from my father.
Your father had that voice.
When I hear myself talk, I hear my father talking through me, which is joy and pain at the same time.
So what was he? So he was down south, right? He lived in.
Yeah, he lived. He helped move them down south in '93, along with other members.
Atlanta,
of my family,
right?
To Atlanta. Yeah. But my father and my mother from 151st Street in Harlem.
So your father, so he had that same kind of voice.
Oh, same type of voice. The voice is here. I'm the little voice off the chip of that block.
Did he sing?
No.
But he just had that
he was
presence.
In the Marines, and if he called you and you was over there at that building,
yeah,
you could not say you did not hear him. I'm trying to tell you now. I grew up in a house where, you know, Martin Luther King also was alive, and every time I heard my father talk, it was like the same, you know.
Did he have I mean, what kind of guy was he?
He was the most amazing man. Just the most incredible
human
being. He had the most powerful man I knew, and the most peaceful, calmer. You know, my father had a father and a motherly instinct about himself. He taught many boys how to be men. He's just, he can go in. My father is the type of dude, right? You know, he was always fearless. We took family trips. He always said, you know, he never cowed down to people, but he always gave people the thing that you had to respect them. Without demanding respect, it's like you had to respect them, and everybody's a human being. He could go to a Klan rally and have everybody serving him food. I'm trying to tell you that. My father, I thought he was a warlock, because he can make you know, we moved furniture. He could put that truck and move it into that door space.
Did you ever see him deal with, like personally deal with, like, a racist situation or somebody disrespecting?
He refused to quit.
He would just...
He had a way of diffusing it with language, timbre, tone, intellect, and he would have whoever the adversary was, like...
So he had the whole so he had that whole package.
Eating out of his hand, man.
Okay, really last question.
And I'm, you know, I mean, he's a New Yorker to the fullest.
And his folks come from where? From where in the South?
Rockingham, North Carolina.
I was going to say North Carolina because it doesn't work. Brooklyn and Harlem, North Carolina, Mississippi, well, no. Chicago,
yeah,
Alabama,
because,
Detroit, right?
Because a straight line, right. You know, Jim Crow meant take your ass north by any means.
Wherever the trains
go. Don't
go
this way, don't go that way. So on the East Coast, it's, you know, Georgia, North Carolina, Mississippi. But when you get further in the west side of Georgia, the straight line goes up to Detroit. I mean, today it's Interstate 75, but you got... What, Tennessee, Kentucky, then you got Ohio.
Yeah.
And then you got Detroit, car plants. And then you got Cleveland plants, car plants were here, tire plants in Akron. Black folks went from south to north. So one thing to study music, which a lot of the study is not in schools, which hurts.
Right.
It's not passed down in families anymore, because I told you we went from broke to broken.
Right.
So that communication stifled and, you know, it's in the archives of other places. But migration, and the music is migration too, because the music traveled. I mean, you studied Chicago blues and find out everybody went straight north.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, everybody happens to be not only just from Mississippi, but the same region.
Hey, I worked in Birmingham, Alabama. The roots of Motown are in Alabama, or in like in the steel towns around Birmingham.
Yeah, of course, yeah. You know, you got Eddie Kendricks come from Birmingham.
That's right.
You know, Melvin Franklin's people come from Birmingham. Straight north.
Lionel Hampton came from Birmingham.
Straight north.
Last question. So when was the first time, how early did you know, did you hear that voice in yourself and know that that was something that was going to change things? It must be an amazing feeling to know you got this thing.
When I saw MCs come out in the beginning of hip hop, and I liked all the radio jocks from WWRL in New York, and they all had this WWRL Super 16, you know, guys like Gary Bird, who became a hero of mine, Mark Rowley, all the guys with Hank Spann, all those guys on black AM radio, they were incredible. And then Vaughn Harper on WBLS later on, these voices spoke and they broke records. And then when hip hop started and people started getting on the mic, I just used to want to go dance and have a good time. But they had a lot of people who were not as good as they thought they were hopping the mic. So I would get on the mic to sit them down. And I wouldn't have much to say, but I could get on the mic and make a Radio Shack mic sound like $1 million.
And people would really recognize
it. And the next guy come on and be like, it doesn't sound the same. But I don't have any other ability in hip hop that's beyond anybody else's. Matter of fact, I had less talent than most MCs, but one thing I knew I had, I said, I can outvoice you anywhere.
And you feel, and the thing...
I knew that from minute one.
But you also have the resonance of knowing that that's almost, that you've kind of got your father's voice to some extent, right?
I don't know if that counted. I wanted to become a sportscaster, so I knew I could make it count that way, and inflections happened because...
See, that's where being Jewish would have totally helped.
Well, you know, but being Marv Albert, being a big Marv Albert fan.
There's six of them up there, like six of them up there from Syracuse. Yeah, well, they're all from the Lincoln High School,
big Marv Albert fan. Yeah. And Marv had this vernacular, you know, Brooklyn, you know, Jewish, but still had a whole lot of black flow in them, and that's just...
Coney Island. He's from that Coney Island area.
Exactly. So, I mean... Go figure, right?
Well, it was really great talking to you. I'll let you go practice.
Thank you, bro.
That was a blast.
Thank you. I'm glad we was able to get in part two. Go Brooklyn. Go Brooklyn.